Let's open our Bibles tonight to the 14th chapter of Deuteronomy. We're going to continue our study of this book. It is a book of Paul. We are, if you remember, there were four sermons and then his farewell address that are contained in the book. This is the second sermon. It's the longest of the four, and we are kind of in the middle of it. And it was written to the second generation of evacuees of the Israelites that left Egypt. This is the ones that were born or grew up in the wilderness, and they're about to cross over the Jordan River into the land of Canaan. And these much of Deuteronomy is a reiteration of what had been said earlier in the books of Exodus and Leviticus as he says this to the new generation. And he starts off with verse 1 of chapter 14. You are the children of the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves nor shave the front of your head for the dead. Now, where my New King James says shave the front, if you got the Old King James, it says nor make any baldness between your eyes. Now, this is not some sort of a diss against unibrows, okay? Don't be thinking that. This is not anything or a pro-unibrow kind of thing. It's not that at all. This is just some sort of a pagan thing that was associated with those days where they would shave the front of their heads to identify themselves with their various idolatry. And it says, for you are a holy people to the Lord your God. And the Lord has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. Again, where my New King James says to be a people, if you got the Old King James, it says a peculiar people. And we are told the same thing in the New Testament. We are called a peculiar people in the King James. In 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, Peter tells us, but ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people. Now, I know when the world would look at us, they would probably amen to that statement. They would say, boy, those are some peculiar people down there, those church people. But I would suggest to you that in the way that God means it, we ain't peculiar enough. You know, it doesn't mean that we're supposed to be odd or strange. It's supposed to be different. That's what he means by peculiar. We're supposed to be sanctified, be set apart by the Lord. When the world looks at us, they should see something different than what they see when they look at the world. We are, as Jesus said in his parable, the pearl of great price. You remember the story of the pearl of great price, where this guy, this rich guy, found this pearl of unspeakable value, and he went and sold everything that he had. He liquidated all of his assets just so that he could obtain this pearl. That's us. We are the pearl of great price, where God paid the ultimate price. He gave the ultimate sacrifice. He paid all, gave all that he had so that he could purchase us to be his own royal priesthood, his own peculiar, special people. When the world looks at us, they should see that there's a difference between us and them. Now, the difference is not primarily in how we look. When we talk about there being a difference between us and the world, it's not necessarily in the way we dress or the way our hair is combed or something like that. It's more about the attitude behind our look. I heard Joe Foss say one time years ago, where he says, I would rather have a church full of people with purple hair in love with Jesus than a bunch of people in suits that were dead spiritually. It's not a matter of how you look. It's the attitude behind the look that shows the difference. And then he says in verse 3, you shall not eat any detestable thing. And the word detestable there literally means disgusting. Like I said last week, the laws of God, the commands of the Lord, are not burdensome. You know, I don't know why the law would have to say don't eat anything disgusting, but it does. And you know, some laws are obviously are easier to follow than others. And this is one of the easy ones for me. You know, I don't eat yucky stuff. The word literally in the Old King James, it says abominable, and that would be you're not going to eat any abominable stuff. And these are the animals, he tells us in verse 4, that you may eat. And depending upon the translation that you have, you know, in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Bible, when the Bible begins talking about some of the animals back then, they didn't have the names that we have that identify the animals today. They were different in the ancient Hebrew. It was more of a description. And so a lot of times we're not real sure what the animals are. So your translation may vary somewhat from mine. But the New King James says you can eat the ox. the sheep, the goat, the deer, the gazelle, the roe deer, the wild goat, the antelope, and the mountain sheep. And you may eat every animal with cloven hooves, having the hoof split into two parts, and that chews the cud among the animals. So the old King James, here in verse 5, where it says that you can eat the mountain goat, it's the word, there it is, pygarg. Now, you may not know what a pygarg is, but the Old Testament tells us, the Bible tells us, that it's a clean animal. It's a good thing to eat. And so it might be good to know what a pygarg is, because you might want to eat one sometime. And actually, it's probably, as the New King James says, a mountain goat. It's a particular species of goat that lives in the highlands. It's similar to the ibex that, if you've ever been to Israel, you're familiar with seeing them there. And then it says, and you got to eat animals that have cloven hooves, but they also have, they chew the cud. Now, when a cow chews grass, when it eats its grass, it first goes into her stomach, and then it goes around for a little bit, and then she burps it back up into her mouth where she begins chewing it all over again. In this process, it gets turned into these little round balls called cud. And you hear that the cow chews her cud. They will do this where they will chew the grass, swallow it into their first stomach, which is called the rumen, and then they will burp it back up into their mouth and chew it some more, and then swallow it back down into their first stomach again. They'll do this as many as 60 times before it will finally pass into the second stomach, which is called the reticulum, and then from there it will go into the third and the fourth stomach, where it goes to its ultimate destination. It's interesting to me that the criteria for these animals were to, one, they had to have a split hoof, a cloven hoof, as the old King James said, and they had to chew the cud. And you could have an animal that has a cloven hoof, but it doesn't chew the cud, like a pig, a swine, and that would be unclean. You couldn't do that. Or you could have an animal that would chew the cud, like the coney, but not have a split hoof, and you couldn't eat that. That would be unclean. You had to have both of those. And many of the guys that like to spiritualize the Bible will notice that the split hoof speaks of our separation, that we are this peculiar people. We're separated to God. That we have we are split away from the world in our dedication and our sanctification to God. And the chewing of the cud, and this, I know the idea of ruminating is kind of gross to us, but the idea of ruminating on the Word of God, not just simply reading it. You know, just you got your verse for the day, and so you read it, and then you swallow it, and then you go on out the door. But you burp it back up, and you chew on it some more. Kind of chew a little bit on the right side, and then chew a little bit on the left side. This is what the Bible calls meditating on the Word of God. And swallow it, and then burp it back up again. Be a separated people who ruminates on the Word of God, if you will. That's what we're called to do, and that's why these animals are considered to be clean. And nevertheless, in verse 7, of those that chew the cud, nor have cloven hoofs, you shall not eat, such as these. The camel. Camel's got a split hoof, or doesn't have a split hoof, but it chews the cud. Hare, rock hyrax, for they chew the cud, and they don't have cloven hooves. They are unclean to you. And then also the pig is unclean to you, because it has the split hoof, but doesn't chew the cud. And so you shall not eat their flesh, nor touch their carcasses. These you may eat of all that are in the waters. You may eat all that have fins and scales, and whatever does not have fins and scales, you shall not eat. It's unclean to you. You know, it's kind of interesting to me, a lot of people, that they kind of get into the Levitical law, you know, the various dietary laws of the Bible, and they say, you know, this is the law that we should even adhere to even today. And yet they come to this verse and they will totally ignore it. You know, if you're going to be kosher, if you're going to completely follow the dietary laws of the Old Testament, you'll never eat lobster. You'll stay away from shrimp etouffee or shrimp cocktails. And you'll never eat catfish, because these animals do not have fins and scales. And yet everybody likes to eat those things. I'm glad that we're not under the Old Testament law myself, because I kind of like pig. All clean birds you may eat, but these you shall not eat. Don't eat eagles. Don't eat vultures. Don't eat buzzards. The red kite, the falcon, and the kite after their kind. So regardless of whatever color kite it is, you can't eat it. You can't eat the ravens after its kind. The ostrich, which is kind of bad because our street's pretty good. The short-eared owl, the seagull, never tempted to do that. The hawk after their kinds, the little owl, the screech owl after their the white owl, the jackdaw, the carrion vulture, and the fisher owl. So all owls, regardless of their shape, size, or color, you can't eat those. The stork, the heron after its kind, and the hoopoe, and the bat. So I hate to spoil some of your after-church dinner plans, but you're not supposed to eat bats. And also, every creeping thing that flies is unclean for you. They shall not be eaten. But you may eat all clean birds. You shall not eat anything that dies of itself. You may give it to an alien who is within your gates. Now, not talking about somebody from Roswell, okay? Just talking about somebody that's not from Israel, a non-Israelite. You can give it to an alien who's within your gates that he may eat it, or you may sell it to a foreigner, for they are you are a holy people to the Lord your God. So basically, when it says that you cannot eat animals that die of itself, this is basically a prohibition against eating the roadkill. You're not supposed to eat roadkill. You can sell it to the Gentiles, you know, saute it and give it to the goyim, and that'll be okay. But you're not supposed to eat it yourselves because you are a holy people. Now, actually, seriously, what this is talking about is if you just run across an animal that had just died of itself, it wasn't slaughtered properly. And because of the regulations for the proper bloodletting and everything, you know, because the blood was supposed to be drained of any animals that were sacrificed or killed, and if it didn't die that way, then it was unclean to eat. And that's what the prohibition is for. And then it says in last part of verse 21, you shall not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. Or if you got the old King James, you shall not see the kid in its mother's milk. Now, this is not talking about some sort of child sacrifice sort of thing, you know, where you're going to take your kid and throw it in a bucket of milk and then boil it. This was talking about it was a sacrifice that they would make to fertility gods. What they would do, this was a common practice among the Canaanites and the Egyptians, is that at the beginning of the season, agricultural season, they would take a young goat, a baby goat, and they would throw it live into the cauldron of boiling milk that was boiled from the mama goat, that was taken from the mama goat, and they would sacrifice this young goat live into the milk, and then they would take the soup that would be resulting from that, and they would pour it onto their plowed ground. And this was a sacrifice to the fertility gods. And so Moses is telling them, through God, don't be doing that. This is the prohibition that you will see if you go to Israel today, and it's very, I mean, you'll see this everywhere. But they have this prohibition, if you weren't aware of it, where they do not ever mix meat with any kind of a dairy product. You can't buy a cheeseburger in Israel, almost. There's a few places if you know where to go. But if you go into a McDonald's in Israel, you're not going to get a quarter pounder with cheese. You know, they just don't do that sort of a thing. And the idea is they have this fear that if you have this cheese and you put it on your burger, that it's possible that the milk that was made from that cheese would have come from the mama of the animal that made the burger. And then you put the two together and you eat it, and it gets down in your stomach and it starts seething. It starts boiling inside your stomach, and you're a violation of this passage. And so in order to avoid that, they will never at any time mix any kind of dairy product with meat. Even though the prohibition was against goats, they will extend this to cows. You can't put cheese on a hamburger. In fact, this prohibition extends even to the chickens. I don't know how you would get cheese from a mama chicken boil your baby chicken in, but they will not even have chicken with any kind of a dairy product. In fact, and for some reason it doesn't apply to fish. Fish is okay. Fish is not considered meat to them, but anything else, any other kind of animal, is qualifies as meat. And so when you go to Israel, usually their breakfast, when you're staying at the hotel or something like that, and the meals are always done buffet style in the hotels. And when you go down to breakfast in the morning, it's going to be meatless. They'll have fish. They'll have usually a big variety of fish. They'll have salad. They'll have fruit. They'll have eggs. And they'll have a lot of cheese. And they'll have a big variety of food, but not only are you not going to get any bacon, you're not going to get any chicken either, you know, because they're not going to ever serve meat when there would be dairy products associated with it as well. In fact, we were there one time, and then at night, when you go to the hotel at night and you have the buffet during the dinner time, that's when you'll serve the meat. And so they don't have any, you can't get milk or cheese or anything like that at dinner. And we were there at this one hotel, one restaurant in the hotel one time, and one of the gals in our group asked if there was any non-dairy creamer for the coffee. And so I asked our tour guide, and he went and asked one of the waiters, and they said, no, we're serving meat. And the tour guide said, yeah, but it's non-dairy creamer. They'd had some for breakfast, but they took it off the buffet line for the dinner. And he goes, but it's non-dairy. There's no milk in it. He goes, yes, but we're having meat. And it wouldn't compute to him that you would even serve a non-dairy creamer because it looked too much like cream. But then, on the other hand, when you're having dinner there, they've got this whole buffet of different kinds of cheesecakes and things with whipped cream on them and all that. It's all made from soy. And so even though it looks like it's made with milk products, it's not, and that's okay because they thought of it. But a non-dairy creamer evidently didn't originate in Israel, so you're not going to get non-dairy creamer with your coffee. But you can have cheese with your fish. That's okay. You shall surely tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. And you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide. The tithe of your grain and your new wine and your oil, the firstborn of your herds and your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. But if the journey is too long for you and you're not able to carry the tithe, or if the place where the Lord your God chooses to put his name is too far for you, when the Lord your God has blessed you, then you shall exchange it for money and take the money with you in your hand and go to the place which the Lord your God chooses. Now, when they paid the tithe back in those days, they didn't write out a check. They didn't do an EFT online. You know, they actually would bring 10% of their grain, or they would have 1 out of 10 of their sheep. They would bring, it was 10% of whatever their produce, whatever their agriculture, whatever their livestock was. And so if you got too far of a journey to go to the place that the Lord had chosen, wherever the tabernacle or later the temple would be, then you could take that grain or that animal, sell it for money, and then carry the money down and pay the tithe that way. That's what he's talking about here. And verse 26 says, and you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep or wine or similar drink, for whatever your heart desires, then you shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. And you shall not forsake the Levite who is within your gates, for he has no part or portion with you. In other words, when they would get there, then they could either pay the money, or they could actually then buy whatever it was they sold up in Galilee. They could buy some goats or whatever it is, and then they could use that, take it to the tabernacle, and then they could share it with the Levites. That was the tithe, was the provision for the Levites. Now, the question that I get asked quite often is, the tithe still for today? And I know a lot of you that have gone here for some time, you've probably heard me teach on this before, and so this will be maybe somewhat repetitious for you. But it is a question that I get asked quite a bit. Are Christians under the tithe? Should we as Christians still tithe today? And oftentimes people that say that the Christians should still tithe, we'll quote Luke chapter 11, where Jesus says in verse 42 of Luke 11, but woe to you Pharisees, for you tithe mint and rue and all manner of herbs, and pass by justice and the love of God. These you ought to have done, Jesus said, without leaving the others undone. And so I've been told many times by people who believe the Christians are under the tithe, they'll say, Luke 11, 42, Jesus told the Pharisees they should have done it. You tithe, that's good, Jesus said. But then someone would raise their hand and go, but excuse me, the Pharisees were under the law. They were under the Old Testament economy. They were under the Old Testament regulations that we're reading about here in Deuteronomy chapter 14. Are Christians under the Old Testament regulations of Deuteronomy 14? And then somebody else will say, well, but tithing antedated the law. It predates the law. Tithing was in effect even before Moses said, bring 10%. In Genesis chapter 14, verse 20, when Abraham was coming back from the battle with the Babylonian kings after he had rescued his nephew Lot, and he came through the town that was called Salem, later to be called Jerusalem, and he met with Melchizedek, the king of Salem. And it says, "And blessed be the most high God, God most high, who has," this is what Melchizedek said to Abraham, "who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And then he, Abraham, gave him, Melchizedek, a tithe of all. And so Abraham paid tithes to Melchizedek a half a millennium before Moses told the Israelites that they had to give 10% of all that they had. So the tithe predates the law, someone will say. Well, but so did the Sabbath. In Genesis chapter 2, verses 2 and 3, it says, "On the seventh day, God ended his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he has done. And then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he had rested from all his work in which God had created and made." So the Sabbath was sanctified and established after the sixth day of creation, hundreds of years before Moses, hundreds of years before the law. So are we still under the Sabbath regulation? Are we supposed to go to church on Saturday? Are we breaking the law by going to church on any other day, or by not going to church on Saturday? Or are we still under the Sabbath? Just because it predates the law, does that mean that we're still under it today? By the way, so is circumcision. You know, circumcision was a provision of the law. But in Genesis 17, verse 10, God says, "This is my covenant." This is what God said to Abraham, again, 500 years before Moses. "This is my covenant which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male child among you shall be circumcised." So, okay, tithing predates the law. And so the reasoning is that even though the tithe was part of the law, since it predated the law, then it would also apply to us today too. But so does circumcision, and so does the Sabbath. And we're not under those regulations and stipulations, so why would we still be under the tithe, someone would say. So then somebody could say, as they're kind of reasoning this and ciphering it all out in their mind, they could say, does that mean that I get to keep all of my sweet moolah? If we're not under the tithes, does that mean that it's mine? And that I don't have to go give? And by the way, if you didn't know it, tithe means 10%. You know, the tithe of $100 is $10. The tithe of $1,000 is $100, and so forth. That's tithe. I've had people tell me, say, "Well, I tithe 5%. That doesn't make sense. You give 10% of, 5% is not 10%, you see. That's what the tithe is. And so if we're not under the tithe, then that means that it's ours? Well, notice what Malachi chapter 3, verse 8 says. Malachi, God says to the Israelites, "Will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, in what way have we robbed you?" And notice God's answer, "In tithes and offerings." This verse is oftentimes used to show that we're supposed to tithe. But Malachi doesn't say, "You've robbed me by keeping the tithes. You've robbed me by keeping the tithes and the offerings." You know what the offerings were? The free will stuff. The things you just wanted to do. The things that the law didn't say you had to do it. It was just that if you wanted to express your love to God, you would give an offering. It would be something that would be over and above your tithe. And Malachi tells the Israelites that you are robbing God not only when you withhold the tithe, but when you withhold the offerings as well. So are we under the tithe? Does Malachi 3:8 still apply to us as the church today? I would suggest to you that we're robbing God when we hold from Him what is His. If it belongs to God and we hold it back, then we're robbing God. And here's the thing. It's all God's. We think about tithing, and we think about, okay, I've got this job, and I make this $100 a week in my job. And so if I'm going to be a good tither, I'm going to write out a check for $10, and then that would be my tithe. That's God's part. That's what I owe God. But the reality is, and this is what the New Testament teaches, the reality is that whole $100 is His. And we oftentimes think this idea of stewardship applies to our finances, to our money, but If it's all God's, then it would be everything, not just simply our money. You know, the Bible talks about children being a stewardship from God. We say our kids, but God says, yeah, okay, you can say that. Just remember whose they really are. You know, we say my money, and God says, oh, it's okay. You can say my money, but just remember it's really my money. You know, we can say my car, my house, my job, my hobby, and God says, it's okay. You can say that. You can use the first person personal pronoun if you want to, but just remember it's really mine. And what God does is that He entrusts us with our money and our children and our houses and our cars and our jobs and our hobbies. He entrusts those to us as a stewardship to see what we'll do with them. It all belongs to Him. See, even under the law, it was considered to be robbery to withhold a voluntary offering. Then how much more would 1 Corinthians 4:7 apply when Paul says, for what makes you differ from another? What do you have that you did not receive? Now, if you did not receive it, or if you did indeed receive it, why do you boast as if you had not received it? You know, if this was true of those under Malachi in the Old Testament, where he says, you have robbed me by withholding the tithes and the offerings, if that was true of those guys under that economy, under what we would normally describe as the dispensation of law, how much more so would it be true of those of us under the dispensation of grace? Now, I'm not saying that Christians are under the tithe. I don't believe that we are. I think tithing is a good place to start. I think it kind of helps somewhat. I mean, you know, if I make $100, should I write a check for the whole $100 and put it in the agape box? I mean, is that the way that I could acknowledge that it all belongs to God? Well, obviously not. And if somebody is only making $100 a week and they've got a family that they're trying to raise, $10 might be a stretch, you see. But if somebody's making $10,000 a week, would it be a stretch to say they should give $1,000? You know, could they not live on $9,000 a week? And so I don't think it's a matter of mathematics. It's a matter of stewardship. It's a matter of recognizing that we are under God's grace, that everything He has is a stewardship, and everything that we do with what He entrusts to us is a statement of our belief in that stewardship. And then he goes on to say in verse 28, and at the end of every third year, you shall bring out the tithe of your produce of that year and store it up within your gates. And then the Levite, because he has no portion nor inheritance with you, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow who are within your gates, may come and eat and be satisfied, that the Lord may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. Now, the language of the Old Testament laws of tithing are somewhat ambiguous. Even the Jewish scholars sometimes have a hard time of figuring it all out. Is this talking about every third year you would take another 10% after you paid the tithe? Or is this every third year you would take part of your regular 10% and set that aside? And the scholars are somewhat divided on what that exactly means. Most of them come to the conclusion, though, that there were three separate tithes. There was the one tithe that you gave, if you had 100 chickens, you gave 10 of them to God. And then of those 90 that you had left, you gave 10% of those. And then of whatever that factors out, you would be given third tithe of the 10% of what's left over. And when you add it all up, it ends up being a little over 27% is what they tithe. I don't even know people that teach tithing thinks that we should give that much. Of course, that also, we need to understand, that also included their taxes. So that's not a bad gig. But it's just a matter of us being good stewards with what God has entrusted to us. At the end of every 7 years, in verse 1 of chapter 15, you shall grant a release of debts. And this is the form of the release. Every creditor who has lent anything to his neighbor shall release it, and he shall not require it of his neighbor or his brother, because it is called the Lord's release. And so every 7 years, there would be this, what was called the Lord's release. You know, when they were told that they could go farm, they were supposed to work 6 days. And then on the seventh day was the Sabbath rest. Then they were told that they could work the land for 6 years. And then on the seventh year, it was the Sabbath rest for a year. They weren't supposed to farm the land for a whole year, just live off of the produce, the increase from the sixth year. And then we learn later that there was what's called the year of Jubilee, that every 49 years, the whole system would reset. But this says here that in the seventh year, during this sabbatical year of rest, that there was what's called the Lord's release, where it says that any debts that were incurred, the person would be released from them. Now, scholars are somewhat divided on this as well. Does that mean that if I owed you $50 and on the seventh year, you just come up to me and say, debt's paid, no big deal? That's what some teach. Others say that what it might mean is that if I owe you $50 and I'm paying you back, and when it comes to the seventh year, then I don't pay you that year. I get the Lord's release during that year. Then when the eighth year comes, then I have to start taking care of the debt once again. It could be something like that. But it was a deal where it was the Lord's release. On the seventh year, there was anybody who had someone indebted to them was to recognize that the Lord was their provider, that he would be the one to pay their bills, not somebody that owed them money. And so every seventh year would be this probably a temporary release during that sabbatical year. Now, of the foreigner, you may require it, but you should give up your claim to what is owed by your brother, except when there may be no more poor among you, for the Lord will greatly bless you in the land which the Lord your God has given you to possess as an inheritance. So if you got some foreigners, you got some people that aren't Israelites and they're living in your land, they owe you $50 in the seventh year, they still owe you. But in the seventh year, any of your brothers, any other Israelites aren't going to owe you unless you come to the place where there are no poor in your land. Very interesting economy that God had set up. Every 49th year, or the 50th year after 49 years, that sabbatical periods of 7 years, all debts would be erased. Any indentured slaves would be released. Everything would just completely reset. They would take the Etch-a-Sketch and turn it upside down and shake it and start over again. Every 50 years, there was a total reset. Never had recessions. Never had stock market crashes. They never had anything like that. It was something that God had handled automatically. And twice a century, it would have this complete overhaul reset. By the way, speaking of economy, why doesn't communism work? You know, communism has been tried for over a century now, where it's been forced upon different people, and there's been various kinds of socialism that has been tried to be implemented, and various forms of fascism and so forth, and it's never worked. Why is that? Well, it's because people are selfish. I mean, all it takes, if you think, well, you know, workers of the world unite and we'll overthrow the bigwigs, and the proletariats will be the ones in charge, and we will, we will run things, and we'll all share the wealth equally. And it's only a matter of time before somebody thinks, well, if we're all going to share the wealth equally, I get just as much as the guy that works a lot. Why should I work so much? And that's why communism won't work, because people are greedy. For the last 50 plus years, the United States has had what they call, if you remember, President Johnson called the War on Poverty. And he started the Great Society, and it was the beginning of the welfare state. Poverty has increased in the United States since the mid-60s. Why is it that welfare doesn't work? Well, it's because people are greedy. That's why. I mean, it just takes somebody to figure out, if I'm going to get paid for not doing anything, and I get paid just as much for not doing anything as I get paid if I do something, guess what I'm going to do? Nothing. And if I get paid more, if I have more kids, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to have more kids. And so welfare doesn't work because people are greedy. What about capitalism? That's the American way, isn't it? What about capitalism? Free market enterprise. How's that going to work? We still got a lot of poor people. You know, we still got a lot of people getting rich, and we got a lot of people getting poor, and we got this middle class that just seems to continue to get strangled in it. Why is that? It's because people are greedy. That's why. The only economic system that works is God's economic system, one that is done unto the Lord. Whenever we try to handle it ourselves, it's always going to get messed up because man is fallen and sinful and greedy. And he says, so unless you find a place where there are no people in your midst, then you will do this. It's only, verse 5, if you carefully obey the voice of the Lord your God to observe and care all these commandments which I command you today. For the Lord your God will bless you just as much as just as he promised you. And you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. And you shall reign over many nations, but they shall not reign over you. You see, the idea of this was all tied to their relationship with God. That was why this system would be successful. The reason why it failed, you know, they were supposed to, on the seventh year, they were supposed to let the ground lay fallow. And there's no record that they ever did that. And so at the end of it, when God was ready to just lower the boom on them and take them away to Babylon in captivity, he says, you owe me 70 of those 70th years, or seventh year. 490 years you owe me. And so he got 490 sabbatical years you owe me. And so that was 70 years is what they spent in captivity. And because the idea of the system was not tied to their relationship with God. Let me instruct this way. Just kind of do a little inventory of yourself right now. How is your horizontal working? You know, you understand what the horizontal is, the things of this world. Not just simply our relationships with each other, but just the our life under the sun. You know, our jobs, our hobbies, our relationships, our homes. How is that working? I mean, do we see that as being successful or do we see that as not being successful? Could it be, if it's not successful, if it's not happening, could it be because we don't have the vertical established? You know, our relationship horizontally is not working because we don't have our relationship vertically working. And it's when we get the vertical going on, then that's when we find out that the horizontal works as well. And that will tend to self-adjust. That will take care of itself if we keep the priority vertically. And this is what God is saying with this. He said, it's all going to be tied to your relationship with me. If you're walking with me, if you're rocking with me, then everything that I'm saying is going to take care of itself. And if there is any among you a poor man of your brethren within your gates and your land, which the Lord your God has given you, and you shall not harden your heart nor shut your hand from your poor brother, but you shall open your hand wide to him and willingly lend him sufficient for his need, whatever he needs. Beware lest there be a wicked thought in your heart saying, the seventh year, the year of release is at hand, and your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cry out to the Lord against you, and it will become sin among you. You shall surely give to him, and your heart should not be grieved when you give to him, because for this thing the Lord your God will bless you in all your works, in all which you put to your hand. For the poor will never cease from the land. Therefore, I command you, saying, you shall open your hand wide to your brother and to your poor and to your needy in your land. By the way, when it talks about the poor, this is not talking about the grifter. This is not talking about the lazy. This is not talking about the person that takes advantage of other people's labors. Paul told the Thessalonians, if you got somebody that doesn't work, then they shouldn't eat. You know, this is not talking about that. But in any culture, in any society, you have those that are legitimately poor. You know, it's not that they're lazy. It's not that they're unmotivated. It's not that they're irresponsible. It's just that it's a fallen world. And some people seem to bear the brunt of it more than others. Solomon, in the Proverbs, he said in Proverbs 19:17, he who has pity on the poor lends to the Lord, and he will pay him back what he has given. And so if you got some guy that has means, and he sees his brother that doesn't have means, and he goes, you know what? It's 6.5 years into the sabbatical thing. In 6 months, it's all going to reset. And so I'm not going to give him anything because he won't pay me back. You know, in 6 months, he's just going to get out of jail free card. God says, you better not do that. You better not harden your heart that way, or I won't bless you. It'll come back to haunt you later. Or if you got somebody who says, you know what, the sabbatical year is coming up here in a little bit. I'm just going to mess up my hair and put on some rags and stand out here on the street corner and have somebody loan me some money. And then when the sabbatical year comes, I can just wipe the debt clean. God says, you better not do that. Because the success of it is all going to be tied to our relationship with God. And if anybody withholds or if anybody takes in a way that is unworthy of that, God will notice. He says, if your brother, verse 12, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman is sold to you and serves you 6 years, then in the seventh year you shall let him go free from you. And when you send him away free from you, you shall not let him go away empty-handed. You shall supply him liberally from your flock, from your threshing floor, and from your wine press. From what the Lord has blessed you with, you shall give to him. And you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this thing today. And if it happens that he says to you, I will not go away from you, because he loves you and your house, since he prospers with you, then you shall... You know, the idea is that if you had somebody that was an indentured servant to you, and he says, you know, okay, I know I owe you $500, so I will work for you for 5 years and I'll pay it off. And so at the end of that 5 years, don't just say, thanks, see you later, but fill him up. Give him a bunch of stuff as he goes away. But if the guy comes to you and says, you know what? I really like this thing we got going on. It's kind of a symbiotic thing. I work for you and you feed me. How about that? I'll just stay here. You're a good guy. I want to stay here. Then it says in verse 17, it says, then you shall take an awl and thrust, you know what an awl is? That's the thing you poke holes in leather when you're belt gets too small because your weights gets too big and you have to poke another hole in it. Use an awl to do that. And he says, you take an awl and thrust it through his ear to the door and he shall remain your servant forever. Well, I suppose so if he's got his ear glommed on the doorpost with an awl. You know, that would probably be a good way of keeping him around. No, what they would do is that when that was just a way, they would do it at the doorpost and they would poke a hole in the guy's ear and then they would put a gold ring in it. And that would serve as a witness to everybody that this servant had earned his freedom. He had been set free, and yet he voluntarily chose to indenture himself to the master forever. And that's what this gold ring would symbolize. This is the idea in Psalm 40 that Jesus identified as a messianic psalm. Okay, Jesus himself said, this is the psalm that David spoke of me. And in Psalm 40, verse 6, it says, sacrifice and offering you did not desire, my ears you have opened. Burnt offering and sin offering you did not require. So then I said, behold, I come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me. I delight to do your will, O my God. Your law is written in my heart. The New Testament word for this, where it says that my ears you have opened. That was kind of an idiom for I've put my ear on the doorpost and had a hole poked through it. Jesus said that of himself. Jesus said, this psalm speaks of me. And that he willingly and voluntarily gave his ear to the doorpost to be the indentured servant. The New Testament word for this is the word doulos, sometimes translated bondservant or bondslave. And don't want to go into it too far because this is our text for this Sunday, but in Psalm or Proverbs, it'd be Philemon. Chapter 2, starting with verse 1, Paul writes, therefore, talking about Jesus, and is therefore, if there is any comfort in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy by being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. So if there's any fellowship, any camaraderie that you have with Jesus, he says, then be like-minded. Verse 3 says, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or deceit. But in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. Verse 5 says, and let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who, being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant. And there, that word bondservant there is the word, the Greek word doulos. He became a bondservant, he became a doulos. Coming in the likeness of men and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross. What Paul is saying is, Jesus Christ became a bondservant. He fulfilled Psalm 40. By becoming one of us, by becoming of man. He took on by coming in appearance as a man, that doesn't mean that he just looked like a man. He was shaped like a man on the outside. He wasn't God with a man's suit on. What that means is that when you looked at Jesus, all you saw was a man. He became a bondservant. He became a man even to the condescension of a slave. And Paul says, if there's any like-mindedness, if there's any affection, if there's any comfort that you find in that, then be like-minded. Be a bondservant as well. Become a doulos as well. Be a doulos of Jesus. And he says, verse 17, also your female servant you shall do likewise, and it shall not seem hard to you when you send him away free from you, for he has been worth a double hired servant in serving you 6 years, and the Lord will bless you in all that you do. So send him away full. Pack them up and tell them thank you if they decide to go. But if they stay, then lay their ear on the doorpost. All your firstborn males that come into your herd, your flock, you shall sanctify to the Lord your God. And you shall do no work with the firstborn of your herd, nor shear the firstborn of your flock. You and your entire household shall eat it before the Lord your God year by year in the place which the Lord chooses. The firstborn, that started way back in Egypt, but the firstborn of all of your animals, your children, your animals, your flock, your livestock, your hamsters, your goldfish, the firstborn male of all of those belonged to God. If it was a clean animal, you would offer it as a sacrifice. If it was a non-clean animal, you would redeem it with silver and then give that. And you would take that sacrifice and go to the tabernacle, and you would have a fellowship meal there at the door of the tabernacle along with the priests. But he says in verse 21, if there's any defect in it, if it's lame or blind or has a serious defect, you shall not sacrifice it to the Lord your God. You may eat it within your gates. You know, I mean, just because your sheep's blind doesn't mean it's not good eating. So you can still eat it there at your gates. The clean and the unclean person alike may eat it as if it were a gazelle or a deer. You can eat it as though it were just any other kind of animal. You just can't sacrifice it to the Lord. Only you shall not eat his blood. You shall pour it out on the ground. Like water. And of course, this speaks of God's firstborn, who was holy and without blemish. He was the perfect sacrifice. He was the perfect bondservant. In the scroll of the book, he said in Psalm 40, Old King James says, in the volume of the book, I have come to do your will. Jesus fully laid his ear on the doorpost of God's will and completely emptied himself of all rights so that he could come and be that spotless lamb, that blemishless sacrifice. And he says, if there's any consolation in that, then you be like-minded. Let's pray. God, give us pause. Let us stop for a moment and just once again look upon that spotless lamb. Think of that sacrifice that was given, that was complete, holding nothing back, that it was perfect, lacking no provision. And the result is that we have been given all things that pertain to life and godliness, that we have been blessed with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places. You have given us all things. And so, Lord, how can we hold anything back? How could we not but come to you and say, here is our ear, Lord, here is our life. May we be your servants forever, voluntarily and willingly, for your glory. God, may that be in Jesus' name. Amen. Questions or comments? Input?